There is a place that is spoken about only in whispers. A dark area that spawns the beginnings of urban legends. A place where anything can happen, and usually does. During the light of day, it hides just outside of view. But when the sun goes down, spirits, creatures of the night, roam free, and things do go bump in the night. It is in every state and every country, and there is no escaping it, no matter how safe you feel behind your locked doors and latched windows. So we invite you to turn down the lights and turn up your radio while we join Dave Schrader and Tim Dennis, your hosts, on a journey into the darkness on the edge of town.
In 1727, a young soldier by the name of Arnold Paul returned home to a village near Belgrade after completing his service. He had enough money to buy some land and a house, and though he was a wonderful neighbor, his social skills were a little less than desirable. As he always had an air of sorrow about him, he finally fell in love with a neighbor girl and they married, though his melancholy still persisted. His wife finally managed to get from him the reason for his sadness. Arnold admitted that while he was on duty one night in a far town, he was attacked by a creature who bit him and tried to drain his blood. He managed to fight the thing off until dawn, when the body fell lifeless and he was able to stake and burn the body to ashes. Before doing so, though, he drank a small amount of the vampire's blood, but being unfamiliar with the local territory, he was unable to find the vampire's grave to extract and consume the dirt from it. Arnold told his wife that he was fearful, since he had not completed the ritual, that he would become a vampire upon his death. Not long after this confession, a loaded wagon of hay fell on Arnold one day in the field and crushed him to death. About a month after his burial, townspeople reported seeing Arnold wandering around the village, and those whom he came in direct contact with died within a few days. After ceaseless nightly attacks, the villagers decided to raise Arnold's body. His case was made unique, and the government officials were actually called out to inspect the body, and an official report is made. In attendance at the public exhumation were two military surgeons. When the sexton finally raised the coffin and pried open the lid, they found Arnold's body in the ground some 40 days fresh in a vampiric state. The sexton exclaimed over the fresh blood at his mouth, "Ah, you didn't wipe your mouth after last night's work, I see." A young attendant of the surgeon's fainted at the sight. Arnold's body, however, was staked and burned to ash. The ashes were replaced into the grave, and several others who were believed to have died from Arnold's attacks were also exhumed and similarly reduced to ash. However, the nightly attacks resumed after 5 years, and another official investigation was conducted, and many more graves were opened, some being in a vampiric state and others being in a normal state of decomposition. Burning the suspected vampires and returning the others to the graves, the vampire plague finally ceased once and for all. The report given by witnesses, military surgeons, and various officials was sent to the highest authority and still remains intact to this day. That's just one of the incredible true accounts of vampire stories that have been around for centuries. This evening, our guest that's come on, we've had her in the past, Rosemary Ellen Guiley. She's back to explore the creepy world of vampires with us. We're going to separate some of the fact from fiction and discuss the rich history of vampire lore this evening. Rosemary is an author of over 30 books covering just about every aspect of the paranormal. She's an authority on many topics, and Rosemary can often be seen on documentaries and TV shows discussing everything from ghosts to vampires to magic and alchemy. Rosemary is a fan of all of our listeners. We're having her back on. We welcome her back to the show this evening. And she does have a book out called Vampires and Werewolves and a brand new book out on magic and alchemy. Rosemary, thank you very much for joining us.
Hi, Dave. It's a pleasure.
Glad to have you back with us this evening. I know we've had the opportunity to talk in the first month or so that we were on the air, and you kind of came on and gave us a little bit of a smattering of all the different topics that you covered. People were so intrigued by the vampire stories and want to know more. That's why I wanted to open up with that story, because I found it funny that in Belgrade they actually have that still on file in the government offices, that that's an actual account of a vampire story.
And it's one of the best, too. It's got a lot of detail in it, but it's also very characteristic of episode after episode that has been documented in the Eastern European vampire cult, something that fascinates us to this day.
What do you believe? Now, I mean, to this date, I mean, vampires, you know, it's a fanciful tale. It's, I think what Bram Stoker took was essence of some reality, some of the horrific, things that happened by Vlad the Impaler, and just kind of blended these things together, but how much of the actual history of vampires as we know them to be do you believe to be a real case?
I believe in real vampires, yes. Not in the Stoker variety, of course. But vampires are a real phenomenon that involve the restless dead and also demonic entities that would be non-human. And what they do is attack the living. The restless dead are unhappy. They come back. They're mean and nasty. They're like poltergeists. They sexually molest people.
Well, that's along the lines of an incubus and a succubus, correct?
That's exactly what a vampire is sort of composed of. Vampires act like poltergeists, like the incubus, succubus, and like the nightmare demon. Those are the main characteristics of real vampires.
Now, the incubus and succubus, though, they've always claimed that that's a totally different entity. They've never actually... So I thought in order to be a vampire, you have to have walked the earth at some point in a human form.
And you're right about one type of vampire, but that's okay. Only one type. There are lots of types of vampires. And the one that we're most familiar with is the Walking Dead. But the Walking Dead can still act in a demonic-like nature to sexually molest people. We have the theme in fiction, thanks largely to Victorian sensibilities, that sex, the vampire couldn't have sex, and the blood drinking was the erotic substitute for that. But actually, in folklore, vampires are pretty randy.
Okay, so you believe that they were, the blood slaking was more of a sexual metaphor from Victorian writing? Do you believe that it was actually taken, did they drink blood, or was it more of a sexual and energy draining vampire than the sanguine, if you will?
Well, here again, we have different types of vampires. There are stories where people feel that their blood literally was drained. And then, of course, when they open up the graves and they saw this, what seemed to be fresh blood exuding from a corpse, that was taken as proof that somehow the vampire was getting your blood. But a lot of people were just sort of energy drained. They would feel attacked by this restless ghost or an entity in the night. They'd wake up feeling bad, and they get more and more listless, suffer all kinds of problems. But ultimately, the vampire takes the life force in whatever is good in life. Vampires can take honey out of bees, milk out of cows, leavening out of bread. They can take your love, your possessions, your luck, whatever makes life good.
Doesn't it sound to you, though, it's more like a... I'm asking you to take yourself out of the realm that you are normally a part of with the paranormal world, which I know will probably be hard for you because it's so entrenched in your life and you've grown up with abilities and able to see and hear and deal with things yourself. But coming out of that, doesn't it just seem like it's a reason in religion or in lack of ability? It seems to go all the way back for centuries of taking responsibility for what's gone wrong in your life and giving it a name, making it a bad guy. It's a vampire. It has nothing to do with that. Couldn't it just be that you just aren't doing what it takes to get you where you need to be in life, and that's why you're being drained of these energies, or you're giving too much energy to drinking or gambling, and instead of taking the responsibility, you're pawning it off on something like a nocturnal creature that comes in and drains you in the middle of the night?
I think it's a little bit of both, actually. It gets kind of hard to separate a lot of these things. Yes, human beings have had a tendency to want to blame something else for troubles, but there is a spirit world, and there are malevolent spirits in it that do prey upon people for these things. And I think that they're very real. Folklore tradition and people's experiences have validated that over and over again, that we have these interactions with the supernatural realm. Some of them are good, and some of them are very unpleasant and very harmful to us. I think that when you take the sum total of people's experiences that have been documented since ancient times, you have to conclude that something's out there.
But creatures that stalk the night and drain us of our blood or our riches or our life or our, you know, livestock, it seems so out there. I mean, it seems like it was made for Hollywood even, you know, 300 years ago.
I think that's why Hollywood jumped on it.
Okay.
But I do think that there are parasitic and opportunistic entities, and that there are certain types of ghosts that don't seem to lie peacefully in their graves, so to speak. They don't make a transition to the afterlife. They're unhappy being dead. They want to come back for curses and revenge. In the case of the vampire cult, there was a tendency to blame interfering ghosts and spirits for things like epidemics, for example, bad weather that would ruin your crops. It had to be a vampire involved. But there's this blurring, and it becomes very difficult to separate apples from oranges. We do have the spirit world with malevolent spirits in it, and I do think that they can cause havoc in the world. They can assault people and create a host of problems for people.
If there is so much, in your opinion, if there's so much of this going on, why does it only happen to such a small portion of people? Why isn't there a better document? Why isn't it happening to scientists and professors that can go out and say this and make a rational plea, or the president? Why isn't the, you know, president haunted by the spirit of some insane vampire at night that's, you know, that's doing this? Why do you feel that it's only, you know, it always seems to be people that are in the midst of a faith crisis or in the midst of their own psychological dilemmas or problems? Is it because they're just at a low point and it's easier to attach themselves to it?
That's part of it. I think some people are more vulnerable than others. They have something in their field of consciousness that is more penetrable, I guess, by sure. by the spirit world. But also I think it's perspective, too. And if these sorts of things are outside of your worldview, then you're going to look for other explanations for your problems.
Well, I'm curious, with all the research that you did for your book about vampires and werewolves, did you see that most of the stories and histories of them, where they were more the handsome Hungarian prince like, you know, Vlad Dracula, or were they more the creepy rat-like creature that was created by, you know, in the movie Nosferatu? The movies seem to romanticize it. They want to make him this sexy, powerful being, you know, Lestat, where he can walk in the room and command everybody's presence. Do you feel that it's more of that, or are they, you know, like humans, they take many different forms and can, you know, be a lesser creepy creature like Nosferatu or a you know, I can't remember the actor's name, and I feel horrible for saying that. Good God, not Lon Chaney.
Max Schreck.
No, he's from Nosferatu, but I'm talking Bela Lugosi, I'm sorry.
Oh, from the original Dracula.
Right, Bela, you know, had a very, an amazing presence. As a matter of fact, he's the only Dracula or only vampire that never actually used teeth, which I always thought was amazing. He didn't use a fake set of teeth. He sold the whole image on what he looked like in his presence on screen. But I've often wondered, with all the accounts and the stories out there, is it more of a creepy, malevolent-looking creature, or is it the handsome, roguish prince that can sweep you off your feet and then suck you dry?
There's really nothing attractive about the real vampire that was documented in folklore. They were specters, apparitions. Sometimes they were recognizable by people who knew the dead person. Sometimes they were invisible entities. But invariably, it was an unpleasant, horrible experience to feel under the attack of one of these things. If it was a non-human entity, that would be more like an ugly demon in appearance. So we've romanticized vampires in fiction, thanks largely to Bram Stoker, who gave Dracula this allure, this mystery of power and knowledge and longevity and especially power over people and women.
Hmm. Well, yeah, I have a hard time, you know, I mean, I'm a fan of the paranormal. I'm a fan of, you know, trying to learn about what's out there. Things like vampires, werewolves, you know, voodoo, like we were just speaking with the guest before you. I have a hard time wrapping my head around, because it just seems so fanciful. And, you know, I understand that so much of myth and mystery is based on a kernel of truth and that these things exist. But what can we do? I mean, as somebody that wants proof of these things in some form of existence, what can I do to seek them out or see them or experience it myself?
I think that a lot of times when you go looking for the experience, it hides. The paranormal is like quicksilver. And that may seem like kind of a cop-out answer, but I think it's true. Our encounters with the paranormal seem to happen to us when we're in the right circumstances. We're in the right consciousness, in the right place in life, in the right place on earth, and something's going to happen to us. Quite often, people don't believe in anything paranormal until they have an experience that they can't explain any other way. And that's what makes it so hard to prove this stuff. It can't be called up on demand. It's not measurable in any sort of scientific way. It can't be described in any sort of scientific way. And psychical research in parapsychology has been very limited that way.
But with the vampire lore, I mean, so much of it can now be explained away medically. There are medical diseases that cause people to be, unable to go out into the sunlight. That it'll actually even cause blistering on the skin, which they've always, attributed to vampirism. The bodies that they would find in the grave that would be, have blood coming out of its mouth, and the bodies would seem to be plump, while others were decaying away. There were all medical explanations for that. Even back in, as far back as the 1800s, they were able to start understanding why the bodies do these things. Why do you believe that the myth of a vampire is perpetuated to this day, when so much of it can be, explained away through medical understanding now?
Some of the medical explanations only cover what I would call a small portion of vampire characteristics. The porphyria, for example, the severe anemia that causes people's gums to shrink and crave things like iron and bloody meat and that sort of thing. That can't really explain vampirism in general. Yes, people have been sort of allergic to sunlight. Actually, sunlight's kind of a fictional invention. There's nothing in vampire folklore that says that vampires don't go out during the sunlight. Even Bram Stoker had Dracula go out during sunlight. He wasn't as strong as he was at night. That's really more of a fictional invention. When people were attacked by vampires, in the cases that were recorded during the height of the Eastern European vampire cult, for example, those attacks happened when people were sleeping, so they naturally were associated with nighttime. There's something about sleep and our dream time where we seem to be more vulnerable to interaction with the supernatural realm. But sunlight and people who say that they can't go out in sunlight after they think they've been turned into vampires, that's a product of fiction.
Well, how about catalepsy?
You mean going into like a trance state?
Well, right. I mean, before there were laws governing certificates of death, and coroners weren't, they didn't have to make sure you were dead, right?
Right.
There was no science of declaring somebody dead because, if they couldn't register with their archaic devices, if they couldn't register a heartbeat or a breath, you were dead. And, so many people were placed in graves and they would, have shallow breathing, heart slowed down in a catatonic state. And people would later open up coffins and find scratch marks and things like that. I mean, there's still even causes to this date where people will be brought down to the morgue and suddenly sit up and it's not a reflex. They're still alive because even today, through medical advancements, we can't always tell when death actually occurs. And isn't that so much of where it also came from? It was pieced together from diseases, from stories like finding the scratch marks inside the coffin and fresh blood, correct?
Well, certainly someone who's buried alive, they're going to stay buried. Mm-hmm. They're not going to escape the grave, and the vampire escapes the grave. But, yes, there were a whole mix of things that got wrapped up into the vampire cult lore. For example, when epidemics swept through a village, people didn't know anything about sanitation and contagion, so they naturally blamed an outside entity. Now, people were already having experiences with pestering ghosts. Those would be the natural suspects, the natural culprits. Hence, the vampire took the rap for a lot of things. But that sort of confusion doesn't negate the existence of vampires to begin with. Not in my book.
All right. We'll be back and discuss more about vampires and about the unseen world around us with Rosemary Ellen Guiley. We'll do that right after this.
The New York Times has raved about the show. The Star Tribune says it's paranormally funny. And the Biscayne Bugle said, how could they put this crap on the air and live with themselves?
I am so sorry for everything that has happened. Because in spite of what Mike says now, it is my fault. Because it was my project. Everything had to be my way. And this is where we've ended up.
Stay tuned. There's more to come from the darkness on the edge of town.
Do you love to travel? Do you love to explore the paranormal? Then join Dave Schrader and Tim Dennis from Darkness on the Edge of Town Paranormal Radio Show as we take our show on the road. January 14th and 17th, we'll be going to sunny Long Beach, California to investigate one of the top 5 haunted spots in the world, the Haunted Queen Mary. Joining us on our journey are the lovely ladies of TV's The Ghost Hunters, Donna McCoy and Lisa DeVall, paranormal investigator Patrick Burns from Court TV's hit new show, Haunting Evidence, and psychic sensitive Chris Fleming from Dead Famous on the Biography Channel. Together, we'll explore the mysteries and history of this famous floating haunted playground. Joining us will be some other special guest speakers and authors. It's a great chance to meet others that are involved in the paranormal and share your interests. For more information and prices, visit our website at darknessradio.com, then click the Trips tab, then click on the Queen Mary. Remember to check back for information on upcoming trips as well. And tune in live each Sunday night to hear a new episode with Dave and Tim and their guests covering all aspects of the paranormal on the Darkness on the Edge of Town. For 58 years, Fate has consistently supplied its loyal readership with a broad array of true reports of the strange and unknown. Fate is a factual magazine containing articles by experts in all walks of life, and by others just like you who have something dynamic, significant, and truthful to say. Keep up with the latest on angels and miracles, psychic phenomena, ghosts, UFOs, archaeological hotspots, alternative science, and much, much more. To receive your free Fate magazine, call now at 1-800-728-2730 or visit our website at www.fatemag.com. That's 1-800-728-2730 or www.fatemag.com. What are you waiting for? Your fate awaits.
Do you want to take charge of your life? We all have our demons we want to get rid of. This is Russ Clark. My hypnosis CD series will help you take charge of your life and kick those demons out. Thousands of people have made personal improvements through the power of hypnosis. Your success is guaranteed by me, or I will refund 100% of your investment. To kick those demons or to add relaxation into your life, visit my website, www.powerhypnosis.net.
Mommy!
Leave me alone!
Do you have ghosts?
Do you have dreams?
Do you have an interest in the unknown? You want to know more about the paranormal? Come and join us in Para-Investigators, the 24-7 online paranormal chat. Visit us today at InfinityParanormal.com and tell us what's been keeping you up in the dark.
If you read Taps Paramag every month, you'll be able to tell the difference between the absurd.
Could not go to work because Bigfoot stole my car.
And the greedy.
Taps Paramag takes you to a few, wherever you go, on purpose. From exclusive interviews with the cast of The Ghost Hunters, the latest trend technology, the feeling of paranormal, to join our journey, go to taps paramag.com.
Try not to fall asleep. We'll only give you nightmares. Welcome back to the darkness on the edge of town.
I've mentioned on the show repeatedly in the past that there are very few people out there, I believe, that actually have the mediumistic psychic ability to actually speak to the dead. And I've been able to call them friends. We have CJ Sellers from CJMedium.com and our friend Robert Baca from Voices from Heaven. I'd like to introduce you to a friend of ours named Barb Powell from Sacred Connections. Had the chance to talk with Barb on two different occasions, and both times she's really blown my mind with the information she's able to come at me with, not just me, but loved ones as well. She is hosting a Halloween special on readings. On October 29th, she's going to be giving consultations that are only $65 for a one-hour session. This also includes the taped CD and aura drawings sent out to you by mail. For more information, you can view her website at www.sacred-connections.us. Again, that website is www.sacred-connections.us. Visit the Halloween special link for more details. Tell her that you're a friend of Darkness on the Edge of Town radio show, and that's why you wanted to check it out. I think you'll definitely be surprised. You'll like it. I've had the opportunity to talk with her myself, and I'm really amazed by what she's been able to do. I'm going to get back into talking a little bit more about vampires. Rosemary, we've got questions that are coming in from people on the boards in an email form that, you know, they want to know about protection. They want to know about the you know, garlic and holy water and silver and frankincense and myrrh or whatever he used to get rid of Jesus or vampires, whatever it works best as. But, you know, before we do that, and I don't mean to keep pressing the point with you. I know you've done so much research on the book, and into the world of the paranormal. But with vampires, in order to believe that there's a cure or a way to fend them off, you first have to believe that they actually exist and that there's something out there. And so far, and again, it's not your responsibility to prove to the world that vampires exist or don't exist, but so much of what's said and so much of the lore that goes out there, it seems to fall on the shoulders of, you know, mental illness, seems to fall. You know, right now, there's fibromyalgia, which is, according to my doctor, a catch-all for stuff that doctors just don't know how to fully diagnose. It's almost like a chronic fatigue syndrome, which leaves you achy and tired and unable to communicate very well because you're always in such a kind of mucked up state. Now, to me, that sounds so much like what people that would claim to be bothered by vampires. So if we were to assume that perhaps some of these diseases that medical science doesn't know how to handle, that were being affected by vampires, you know, in one sense or another, what is there to work? I mean, so much of it is Hollywood. This, you know, like I said, the sunlight, I always believed to be one of their stories. And as you're telling me that according to actual lore, the sunlight was never part of why a vampire or, you know, something that a vampire is afraid of.
Well, and also not casting a reflection in a mirror. That's an invention of fiction as well. There's a lot of folklore about mirrors being soul stealers and portals for demons and the dead should never see themselves in the mirror, that sort of thing. But nothing says vampires cast no reflections. So the thing is that we've come to see the vampire as an entity that's been created largely by entertainment, by fiction and film. And that obscures the real supernatural entity. If you look at a vampire in the broadest possible definition, it's a supernatural entity, which could include a ghost, a restless dead, or a non-human agent who harasses the living and draws off vitality, takes the life force in some way. It could be through an essence, through material things. It could be literally through health. So that's the broadest definition. And I don't think that one needs to be mentally unstable to have encounters with supernatural entities of that nature. We don't think that of people who have encounters with angels. That seems to be okay, but we sort of look sideways at people who have encounters.
Well, it depends on who you talk to. So many people, you know, I mean, I like you a lot, Rosemary. You know that. We've been friends for, you know, over a year now. We've had the opportunity to talk in person and, you know, personally about things that we've had experience in our life and the paranormal. But, you know, I mean, there are still things to me that just come off so insane. And again, no disrespectfully, but, you know, I mean, I look at you as an authority on so much of the paranormal, and then to hear you admit that you've seen fairies, to me, shakes a lot of credibility on what you say, because to me, it's like, oh, come on, Tinkerbell? Now, I'm curious, because I've now, as I'm doing more research into the paranormal myself, things that I'm reading, like fairies, gnomes, leprechauns, they're not the cute little cuddly creatures that we've, you know, grown to love and appreciate on TV. They are from, a lot of them are more of a darker creature. You know, I guess they're going to cover that in the TV show Ghost Hunters coming up with the European episodes that they did, and they're going to give a little bit more of the lore. But what type of fairies did you purport to see? I mean, were they the evil incarnations, or was it Tinkerbell flipping around your room?
Well, Tinkerbell was a Victorian fiction invention, mm-hmm. and that also has colored a lot of our ideas about fairies.
Right, and that's why I want to give you a chance to talk, because I know that, you know, on one of the past episodes, people were, oh, God, we love Rosemary. Oh, she's so intelligent. She sees fairies? What? And I want to give you a chance to explain for yourself, because it does sound nuts. You know, I mean, what fairy, you know, that's all we know is they are, you know, they pop in and they change a pumpkin into a carriage and they make our clothes and, you know, build our shoes, and they're silly little creatures. What did you see? What have you seen? What have you experienced in your own life with fairies?
Well, a number of different experiences. Fairies are connected to the natural world. They're associated with the elements, with things in nature. In folklore, especially in Celtic folklore, they keep to themselves a lot, and they're not very kindly disposed toward human beings. In fact, in earlier times, people were very wary, even afraid of fairies, because fairies had powers and might affect you in sorts of negative ways. And it is possible to have a visionary experience of these entities associated with nature in much the same way as one might have an experience seeing an angel, for example, or even seeing an apparition. They're part of the cosmic creation. They come in all kinds of forms, I would say. They're not, again, this Tinkerbell fluttering around with tiny little wings waving wands.
Mm-hmm.
That's Victorian art and literature. They can appear as tiny little lights, balls of light moving around in the woods. They may appear as small diminutive humans, the gnomes, the dwarfs, the trolls. They look like little people, and they may...
Now, when you're saying little people, do you mean, you know, like what we know as midgets or dwarves, you know, that are known as now little people, or are you talking about little people like miniaturized versions of Tim and I running around the forest?
I'm talking about...
It's just kind of frightening when you think about it.
I'm talking about beings that would be about 2 to 3 feet in height. Now, some people...
Perfectly proportioned, or... Now, they've actually found a village. Now, you know, I mean, this is where I'm so interested by this, and I'll explain why I'm bringing this out on a vampire show. But they've actually found a village, have you heard this, where they've dug up remains, they're calling it the real hobbits. They've found these small people that are perfectly proportioned small people that they can't explain into the race at this point.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a communion of, or a community of them. You know, I mean, do you believe, like with cryptozoology, there are just some things out there that still exist we just haven't found yet? Papua New Guinea, they're finding new things all the time there. They found new varieties of animals, butterflies, flowers, things that they've thought extinct for millions of years, they're finding live, you know, in and around Papua New Guinea. Do you believe that there's just still more of this out there we just haven't seen? Or is it all of this mysterious, ethereal, you know, creepy little creatures digging around in the forest?
I think there's probably a lot that exists on this planet that we may not know about. And certainly one of the explanations of fairies is that they have their origins in races of diminutive people.
Mm-hmm.
So that's certainly a possibility. But then there's also the body of anecdotal experience where people have had encounters with beings who live in the earth and are a part of the earth. I think that, you know, the thing about this whole thing about is something real or isn't it, and, you know, we're talking about how do you prove it. Well, you don't really, and I hear what you're saying, Dave, about, you know, skepticism and, you know, stretching your boggle point and all that, because I used to be very skeptical of a lot of things that I'm now very open-minded about, and it's only been through years of research and having some experiences myself and also considering the weight of anecdotal material that's out there that I've been more open-minded about what are the things that people experience that don't seem to be quite of this world.
But don't you find that anecdotal, you know, it isn't really worth a whole lot? You know, I mean, I have an anecdote from when I was a child, and I was at, about 10 years old. My cousin was 8 years old. We were down fishing by my grandparents' pond, and used to be, they had 40 acres of untouched, you know, nature just everywhere. And you would hear loud things walk. I mean, it was loud, like something big was walking around back there. And there was the one time we were sitting there fishing at the pond, and we heard the stomping, and it kept getting closer and closer and closer. And at one point, we looked up, and I see this gray, furry thing in the bushes looking back at us, scared the living crap out of my cousin and I. Now, you know, I'm almost 40 years old. That happened 30 years ago. You know, through history, the story has changed slightly and has become more frightening or more funny, depending on the drink I'm drinking at the time when I tell the story. But, you know, I mean, my cousin, who was 2 years younger than me, remembers seeing the glowing eyes. Now, you know, going back out there a few days later, they have these huge gray squirrels that hang out in their trees out there, too. So, you know, was I just hearing nature happening out there? And I saw a giant gray squirrel in a bush and saw part of his tail, which looked like the side of a head and part of the body. So much of it can be you know, now in adult eyes, so much of what I saw is what I thought was from a childhood, I question now. And, I'm just curious, with anecdotal evidence, though, isn't so much of it so easily dismissed? You know, I mean, the story I read, they've actually got, at the beginning of the hour, I read a story about a vampire story that is actually a case file. And if you go to Belgrade, I guess, in the ministry files, they actually have this history and the storyline of this that occurred. And military was called in and religious leaders were called in to deal with what they believed to be a vampire sect. So, you know, I mean, I can understand that's a pretty interesting story in itself because so many people were brought into it. And, you know, it wasn't the, 800s or the, 900s. It was, almost 200 years ago or a little over 200 years ago. So things were already happening and we were smart enough to understand the difference between, what was going on and not with the supernatural. So that, that when you have so many people that can tell the exact same story and experienced it, to me is so much more important than one anecdote from, 100 different people telling you that they saw Bigfoot out in the, bayou when they were out drinking beer with their cousin Billy and fishing. Or the memories of a child seeing a fairy or balls of light that could be now explained as swamp gas or a collection of fireflies from a distance that were potted that looked like a larger light moving through the woods. Do you ever question the anecdotal evidence that you get yourself, or do you ever question your own memories and beliefs and think, God, am I nuts? Is this crazy?
I have to question things all the time. And I think you have to look for natural explanations first before you can consider paranormal explanations. And sometimes you're left with no clear weight on one side or the other. You have to assess it in terms of how you intuitively feel about something. The thing about anecdotal evidence is that similar kinds of experiences have been recorded through history across the board, across the planet, by very different cultures that had no real contact with each other. And they indicate that human beings have had an ongoing, what I would call, core set of experiences with the supernatural realm that fall in certain patterns. And so it's not proof, but it's evidence in support of. We can't prove reincarnation either, but there's a lot of evidence in support of reincarnation. And so people believe in reincarnation or they don't believe in reincarnation. And it's the same thing with our encounters in the supernatural, that the weight of historical personal testimony indicates that we have certain kinds of experiences. They sort of take different clothing, so to speak, depending on your culture and time period, but the core experience has continued through history.
Well,
and
the
vampire experience is one of those.
But one of the things that I found interesting, I'm a numismatist. I've been involved in collecting coins and been in the coin world for the last 15, 20 years here. And got a minute, we're going to go to break, but it's something to kind of mull around. The one theory is how could all of these different cultures from around the world that don't supposedly have a way to communicate with each other. But, one of the biggest forms of communication back then was in the monetary forms that they used. When the Olympics were coming, the Romans would begin striking coins with Olympic images on them, wrestlers, different things that took place during the original Olympics, and they began spreading the money around, which actually spread throughout the world, alerting people that the Olympics were going to come up. Because there wasn't commercial, there wasn't paid advertising, there was no Goodyear blimp to fly over, the Andes and let people know that the Olympics were coming up. So many of the tales that we've seen and heard have been shared through maps and through coinage and through forms of money that have been traded throughout the world through trading ports and such. Don't you think that maybe a lot more of the information escaped than we give credit to because of things like that?
Well, it's quite possible, but I also think that if people didn't have those experiences, it wouldn't have entered their own folklore either. Take the angel lore, for example. The Judaic angel lore was influenced by their exposure to other cultures, like the Babylonians. But if the Babylonian experience was entirely alien to them, it's my personal feeling that it wouldn't have been absorbed into their own lore. Characteristics of it were absorbed into their own lore, and that got absorbed into Christianity and into Islam. and there are angel-like beings in mythologies around the world, not called angels per se, but having similar characteristics and duties and interactions with people. So it's a very subjective world out there. The paranormal is very subjective and based on unique mixes of experiences. But like I said, there's still the core patterns that have run throughout our history.
Okay. Well, just everybody keep your dial here tuned on the darkness on the edge of town. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back right after this commercial break with our guest, Rosemary Ellen Guiley.
It will keep you on the edge of your seat.
I must have drank me about 15 Dr. Peppers.
I got to pay.
Just don't get any on the floor. Hurry back. There is more to come from the darkness on the edge of town.
For 58 years, Fate has consistently supplied its loyal readership with a broad array of true reports of the strange and unknown. Fate is a factual magazine containing articles by experts in all walks of life and by others just like you who have something dynamic, significant, and truthful to say. Keep up with the latest on angels and miracles, psychic phenomena, ghosts, UFOs, archaeological hotspots, alternative science, and much, much more. To receive your free Fate magazine, call now at 1-800-728-2730 or visit our website at www.fatemag.com. That's 1-800-728-2730 or www.fatemag.com. What are you waiting for? Your fate awaits.
Mommy!
Leave me alone!
Do you have ghosts?
Do you have dreams?
Do you have an interest in the unknown? Want to know more about the paranormal? Come and join us in Para-Investigators, the 24-7 online paranormal chat. Visit us today at InfinityParanormal.com and tell us what's been keeping you up in the dark.
If you read Taps Paramag every month, you'll be able to tell the difference between the absurd.
Do not go to work because Bigfoot stole my car.
And the creepy.
I don't
want Taps Paramag takes you to a few would never go on purpose. From exclusive interviews with the cast of The Ghost Hunters, the latest trend technology, the feeling of the paranormal, to join our journey, order at Taps Paramag.
If you want to listen, it's your funeral. Welcome back to the darkness on the edge of town.
Freaky intro. Before we were going off to the break, I was talking about, I know the show's about vampires and people want to know more about vampire lore, and I brought up things with the angels and with fairies and seeing that. Now, the reason I do that is it seems that in a lot of articles and stories that I've read that so much of that all seems to tie together into vampire lore, that some of these fairies and smaller creatures that have been seen that are more of a malevolent force have also been mistaken or believed to be vampiric in nature. Rosemary, we were talking about anecdotal evidence and where it is and what you can accept and what you can't accept. I want to know, have you had an experience to make you believe in the reality of vampires, or do you have a firsthand anecdotal account from somebody that you know and trust and believe that vampires exist? And if so, I'd like to hear about that.
Well, you have to keep in mind that my definition of a vampire is very broad.
Sure.
It's not just a blood-sucking entity, but an entity that harasses you, causes the disturbances, nightmares, supernatural sexual molestation, some poltergeist effects, and that sort of thing.
So vampire is kind of like fibromyalgia. It's just a catch-all for all the crap we don't really understand what's going on, right?
I mean, that's a supernatural sort, yeah.
Sure.
So now I have not been attacked by any entity like that. I have been in haunted places where I have felt very unpleasant things there, things that were non-human in nature. I have not been assaulted at night, but I
But what's the difference between a vampire and a demonic entity then? Or are they just one and the same or just a shade of each other like a cousin?
it gets very hard to draw the line. And, in fact, if you try and draw the line, you find a lot of what I would call cross-contamination in folklore. It gets very difficult to distinguish, is this, for example, an incubus or is it a vampire? Because the descriptions might be the same, but the labels would be different.
Mm-hmm.
And this is often the case in paranormal experience. And this is what I'm getting at with these core experiences. Human beings have had core experiences that they attribute to supernatural interaction or interference, and the labels change, some of the clothing, so to speak, changes, but the core experiences are the same. So, yes, you could consider a very unpleasant kind of haunting, vampiric in nature, if whatever is present in a haunting is causing nightmares, comes and harasses somebody sexually while they're sleeping, creates unpleasant poltergeist disturbances. These have a negative effect on the life force. That is what makes you feel good about life. So in the broadest sense, that's a vampiric kind of haunting.
Well, let me ask this. You know, so many paranormal investigators and psychics, mediums, people that are in touch or sensitives will say when you go into a bar, all the smoke that you see up at the ceiling isn't always necessarily from a cigarette. It's a lot of the entities that still crave the life that they had, and they live there off of the misery or the excitement or the happy or the lust or the whatever the hell's energies are being pumped into a bar. Do you believe them then to be spirits, or are they spirits that have a vampiric nature? I mean, have you heard that theory before? Let's start off with that. And if so, what are your takes on it?
Well, I certainly have heard that about, especially about bars and, you know, spirits liking to hang around. We have had cases on record where entities that communicate say that, you know, they enjoy somebody smoking or somebody drinking and they get some sort of essence kick off that. But I wouldn't go so far as to say all smoke in a bar is really spirit.
Well, I didn't say that. I just said not all smoke is from cigarettes. A lot of it is the spirit activity taking place in the bar, and that's what's hovering around you and kind of sucking off your essence. So isn't that, in effect, a vampiric effect?
If it makes the...
So, I mean, if they're getting a contact high, yeah.
If it has a negative effect on the living, yes. The living person would have to feel negatively affected by that, would have to feel that they've been depleted, wasted away, harmed in some way. And in fact, in folklore, restless spirit mm-hmm. is jealous of the living. That's one of the underlying beliefs about vampires, is that the people who don't pass on happily into the afterlife, don't make the transition, they're very upset about being dead. They want the things that the living have, and that's pleasure in life. Material pleasure, sexual pleasure, sensory pleasure, and that's what they come back and try and get, which is why a number of accounts have the sexual component to them, why they have the disturbances in the home.
Mm-hmm.
It's the angry spirit being angry and being dead, so to speak.
But if the, you know, do all vampiric experiences have to be of a negative sort? Now, I believe it was on the special that I saw that aired last year that you were part of and that vampire, self-proclaimed vampire Don Henry, who, you know, he was on that TV show Mad Madhouse. He's got the long goth hair and the, you know, leather outfits and the fake eyes and fake teeth. And again, I'm not discounting him. I'm just saying, explaining who he is for people that haven't seen it. There was also, now was it Michelle Bellinger that was also on that special talking about energy vampires? And, you know, I mean, first of all, do you remember if it was Michelle Bellinger that was on there? Talking about that, or was it a different female that had a vampire friend that would suck the energy, or she would drink the energy from this person? That didn't seem to be a negative thing. It seemed to be something that they were relating back and forth to each other. And I guess that also begs the question then, do you believe that the Don Henrys and the Michelle Bellinger's or the people that are self-proclaimed vampires and energy vampires, that they're, you know, is that any credibility to it, or is it just a bunch of kids playing dress-up?
I think the origins of the this vampire subculture can be traced to fiction, that
mm-hmm.
people have looked to fictional models for what they think vampires ought to do. And yes, there is energy vampirism. That's a form of psychic attack. But the blood drinking and the so-called positive aspects of vampirism, those are drawn off fiction. But what I find very interesting about the vampire subculture, I don't mean to discount it in any way, because if it gets big enough and extensive enough, it's going to literally create its own mythology. The vampire subcultures have their own history, their own language, their rules, social order, hierarchies, beliefs, and
right. I guess the question is, do vampires exist? We can't say no anymore because there are people that dress up and have the fangs and drink each other's blood in real life. They actually do this. So, I mean, vampirism has created its own monster, wouldn't you say? I mean, we've taken fiction and created a reality out of it.
It's life imitating the fiction, and but yet it's in the process of creating its own reality. And if the vampire culture subculture goes on long enough, I think it will become another kind of vampire. Or if it hasn't already become another kind of vampire.
Now, energy vampires, people that feed off... Now, you believe, because you've got some psychic abilities yourself, and you can see... Now, did you say you could see auras or the energy field around people?
Yes, I can.
Okay. So, if I was an energy vampire... Now, can you be an energy vampire without knowing you're an energy vampire? Is that the friends that are always complaining and bitching and whining to you, and you help them, and you just walk away at the end and feel like you're about ready to black out yourself? Is that a form of energy vampirism, or is it just somebody really bringing down your own energy field?
It is a form of energy vampirism. You can be an unwitting vampire because your presence is draining on somebody else's presence. But psychic attack is very deliberate. It's knowing what you're doing. It's knowing how to make somebody else weak and depleted so that you can feel regenerated.
Okay. Is there a way that I could give... You know, Tim's feeling run down today, and I'm super amped up. Is there a way I can give him some of my essence?
Hey, now.
I knew that was coming. Is there a way I can give him some of my essence or energy where I'm not totally draining myself, but I'm helping him get it? And I know I think that's Reiki and things like that. Is that correct?
Well, actually, you wouldn't want to give someone your energy. And when you do energy healing, you become a channel for the universal life force, which is the source of all plenty, for that to come through you to benefit somebody else. One of the mistakes that people make when they get into energy healing is they start giving of their own energy, and then that becomes very depleting for them. So in healing, you're really channeling something else through you to somebody. So, yes, you could learn how to do that.
So you're saying that if I've got a bunch of energy, I shouldn't. There is a way for me to give it to Tim, but I shouldn't. I should... If I'm interested in doing that, learn something like Reiki or energy healing where I can open up and accept the universal light, if there is that, to give to him to help replenish his energy. But then that way I don't have to give up my own.
That's right.
Okay.
If you start giving up your own energy, then it weakens your defenses. And sometimes people, when they start an energy healing and they do that perhaps unwittingly or out of a desire to be helpful, it's possible for them to pick up what the other person has, you know, some of the characteristics of whatever's bothering them.
Well, that the girl that I was talking about earlier on the special that you did about vampires last year, she, you know, she had a little underling, if you will, that hangs out with her and lets the vampire draw from her. And, you know, I'm curious, you're an intelligent woman. How much of that do you believe is just the power of positive thinking, and she's feeling run down, so she starts inhaling and breathing deeply by this woman's neck and throat and breast and you know, is becoming more re-energized? How much of it is just a power of positive thinking that she just wants to get re-energized and feel better, and how much of it is real? And, I mean, is that, I don't want to put you on the spot, but I do. I mean, is she a crackpot? Is that crazy? or do you believe that that's a legitimate form of energy transference? Or, like I said, to me, it would just seem like it's more of just trying to, you want it so bad, you're convincing your body and mind of it. It's like being cold. There's days I can go outside here in Minnesota and I'm freezing without my jacket, and I just stop and I think, I'm not cold, and it stops being cold. You know, and there's proof of that at every Green Bay Packers game you can watch during the winter, and you got every, you know, paint thinner drinking fool out there without a shirt on in the middle of sub-degree weather. I mean, to me, that seems like it's more of a focus of your own energy than it is actually, you know, drawing off of somebody else.
Well, placebo effect has been very well documented to the point where it's hard to call it a fake effect, really, because it demonstrates the power of one's focused mind in order to experience something tangible in the physical world. The placebo effect has been tested, for example, in prayer studies and in people being given medicine where they're told it might help them. They don't know if they're getting the sugar pill, so to speak, or the real medicine. And then people who get the sugar pill wind up showing improvement. So a lot of it does have to do with how we perceive things. And once again, we're in this tricky subjective area where it gets very difficult to say what's real and what's not real.
Well, Rosemary, we've got a minute left. Do you believe that there are vampires walking this earth that are more like the Hollywood form, that are dark, malevolent creatures that aren't necessarily all human, that are out there draining the life blood or life force from other humans?
I do not believe in the Bram Stoker Dracula or the Lestat vampire.
Okay. Sorry, Tom Cruise, you're out of a job, I guess. You no longer exist. Rosemary, let's talk about your new book. It's coming out. It's already out, right? Magic and Alchemy?
It is, yes.
Okay, and if people want to order it, they can go directly to your website, correct? At visionaryliving.com?
That's right.
Okay, so for more information about Rosemary and the 30 books that she's written, and if you're interested in getting copies of Vampires and Werewolves, or if you're interested in getting Magic and Alchemy, you can go directly to her website at visionaryliving.com. You can tell her that you heard her on Darkness on the Edge of Town Radio. I'm sure you probably even get a signed copy if you ask her nice. Is that right?
Absolutely.
All right, that's good to hear. Rosemary, in wrap-up, is there anything you want us to know or take away from tonight about vampires that we should be aware of?
I think it's important to be open-minded, and I'm not talking about subjectivity as a cop-out in any way. It's very subjective, our experiences with the paranormal, and a lot of times we just have to assess for ourselves what is it we experience. I think it's important to be open-minded, but be skeptical first. Look for natural explanations, then consider the paranormal.
Well, thank you very much for joining us this evening, Rosemary. It's as always a pleasure having you here in the darkness on the edge of town. Make sure you tune in with us next week as we continue to delve into the mysterious world of werewolves and witches. And we'll be back with more shows with John Zaffis next week and author Linda Godfrey talking about the possibility of real werewolves that might still exist today. Thank you very much for listening to the Darkness on the Edge of Town Paranormal Radio Show, and we hope to have you back with us again next week.